If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And yes, this is episode 264 of the Columbia Calling podcast. It's a very exciting episode because we have repeat guests on the show. You'll remember from episode 251 last year, we had an unnamed academic talking about the reintegration, reincorporation, and demobilization of the FARC guerrillas all over the country. She'd done hundreds, if not several hundred interviews. This is for her PhD thesis. Well, she's back on the show, and let me just reflect that episode 251 was incredibly popular and had some very, very positive feedback. Well, she comes back on this episode 264. As yet, we're unsure if she's going to reveal her name to us. Of course, she remained anonymous in the last show because she was here in Colombia, but now she's back in her home country, and perhaps, you know, she can speak a little bit more openly about her experiences. But this time, she'll be discussing her interviews with the AUC paramilitaries and their takes on the demobilization, reincorporation, and reintegration of their rank and file. Of course, those of you who know a little bit about Colombia will realize that that took place around a decade ago or a little bit longer. So we get to compare and contrast both experiences, both the FARC and the AUC. And therefore, we can take a little bit of a look and perhaps make some conclusions from what's going on around us here in Colombia today. Before I hand over to Adrian Alsimer of Columbia Reports for his segment on the news, his updates of what's going on in Colombia, I'd like to say a big thank you to all of those of you who tune in, week out, and share the love by spreading the word about Columbia Calling. It has been reflected in our downloads and our listener charts. There's definitely been an upsurge in our listeners. So this is fantastic news, and of course it's incredibly flattering. I think it's in no small part, I think responsible for this is Adrian Alsimer of Columbia Reports, because of course his network is so big, but also perhaps people are taking more of an interest in Colombia. Maybe that's because Venezuela is alongside us, but I think, you know, maybe we've hit the right vein of form, and we're finding the right people to interview, and those of you out there are happy with our service. So this is very flattering. I'd like to say a big thank you to all of you out there. And one final anecdote before I sign off to hand over to Adrian. So I got a message from a friend here in Bogota, an American expat, who said, well, you know, it's all well and good. You give these highbrow interviews and episodes of the Columbia Calling podcast. But those of us here in Bogota and around Colombia, what we really need are the details of an honest, honest, reliable, and a decent plumber. So thank you, Chris, for that one. I will try and endeavor to find a space in the Columbia Calling podcast at some point in the future to give some more practical information for those of you over here. But of course, I don't want to turn my back on the international audience, which is far bigger than that here in Colombia. So anyway, Chris, I'm looking for a plumber for you, but as yet I haven't found any. Now I will take a short break and hand you over to Adrian Alsimer with the news. Thank you for listening. Please don't go away.
My name is Adrian Alsma, and this is the News for Colombia Calling for March 12, 2019. Colombian President Iván Duque returned a bill that defines the powers of the country's war crimes tribunal to Congress on Sunday. The president's move is his biggest blow to the country's peace process since Duque took office last year. The president deemed parts of the bill inconvenient despite international pressure and warnings by the International Criminal Court that such a decision could trigger criminal investigations from The Hague. Duque and his hard-right party, the Democratic Center, have long opposed the war crimes tribunal that seeks justice for the more than 8.5 million victims of Colombia's armed conflict. A judge suspended the indictment of a prosecutor of the war crimes tribunal and a former senator for allegedly trying to stall the extradition of a FARC leader. According to the Inspector General's office, the prosecution has no evidence that would prove that the prosecutor and the senator sought to frustrate the extradition process of Jesús Santrich. Local media have coined the possibility that the prosecution illegally entrapped the suspects together with the DEA that has accused Santrich of drug trafficking but has failed to produce evidence. A deputy of the Assembly of Chocó, a war-torn province in the west of Colombia, was found murdered on Wednesday. Deputy Ellison Mosquera and two of his assistants were murdered while on campaign ahead of local elections that are set to be held in October. Mosquera and his assistants were murdered in a jungle area where ELN guerrillas and AGC paramilitaries are active. Netflix will air a series based on 100 Years of Solitude, the epic novel of the late Colombian Nobel laureate Gabriel García Márquez. According to the late author's son, Rodrigo García, his family has agreed to give Netflix the right to produce the series that could air as early as next year. The series will be partially shot in Colombia, García told newspaper El Tiempo. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Yes, you'll have heard and tuned into Adrian Alsema's news update for this episode 264. And it's with very great pleasure I invite a former interviewee back on the show. You'll remember her from episode 251 when we talked about what is happening to the FARC guerrillas right now. I wasn't allowed to say her name last time. I don't know if I'm allowed to say her name this time, but that's up to her to decide right now. But it was episode 251, and really fascinating and incredibly popular show. She's an academic up there in Ottawa right now, and for the rest of her thesis, she's been also not just interviewing, you know, demobilized or I remember that reincorporated. There was this issue of these words, FARC guerrillas, but she's also been talking to members of the AUC, or the Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, the paramilitary groups too. So this is about the broadest thesis, and with such an incredible amount of information that, you know, I really shouldn't talk anymore. Let me welcome my guest from Ottawa. Do you want to say your name?
Sure, we can use my name today because I'm not in country anymore.
Okay, so Rachel Schmidt, welcome back on Colombia Calling.
Thank you so much. It's good to be talking again.
I know, it's a real pleasure to have you back. Tell us a little bit of how your research has continued with the FARC and now into the AUC.
Honestly, it's all such a big blur. I can't exactly recollect where I had all been last time we spoke. But I'm back in Ottawa now. Fieldwork is wrapped up. I've been told not to go back because I have too much data. As much as I was hoping to go back in February and do some more interviews, I did not. So I ended up going to two different safe houses where I spoke to ELN and FARC deserters. And as well, I went to three different reincorporation sites. I don't even know what to call them anymore. So they used to be Zonas Veredales. Now they're called ECTRs, which is a very long Spanish acronym. But basically the reincorporation camps where some FARC members still are. I went to three of those. And then I ended up going to two collective demobilization sites where there are ex-combatants from the AUC. These are where groups of paramilitaries kind of got resettled into farms, which I didn't even know had happened, to be honest. So this these farms are, it's the land of I can't remember his name now, one of the huge drug traffickers in Colombia, and they basically split this big farm in half and gave half to one set of paramilitaries and half to the other set of paramilitaries. And so now it's kind of this strange, ironic twist of these ex-paramilitaries living on former land of a Colombian drug trafficker. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. So so that's where I ended my trip, really, is interviewing about 30 ex-combatants from the AUC.
And these guys, they demobilized, reincorporated. It's a ways back. I mean, these are the guys that demobilized in the, was it the Ralito Accords in Cordoba under President Uribe?
Yes. So between 2003 and 2006 is when the demobilizations took place. But demobilizations, entre comillas, no, in quotations, because that paramilitary demobilization was widely criticized for not being very thorough. They didn't dismantle the criminal networks. They didn't really dismantle the financial networks. And so a lot of the commanders, especially middle commanders, just continued on with their criminal activity under different names. So it's been widely criticized as not, even though the government lauded it as a very successful demobilization, it really wasn't. And that was quite evident when I was talking to these ex-AUC guys by the extent to which they talked about this ongoing criminal activity in their networks. And I was kind of hoping that the government had learned from that whole process, but a lot of the same things are happening now with the FARC, so it makes me a little bit concerned.
So your overwhelming feeling is not one of great positivity.
Well, I feel a bit torn about this because I do feel like, you know, the overall environment in Colombia is, for many people, much better. The overall security situation is better. You can, you know, travel buses overland in places where you couldn't do before. But on the flip side, in some rural areas, the security situation is worse. So in some areas that used to be FARC stronghold territory, there are different criminal gangs and Mexican drug cartels and all kinds of groups moving in and clashing with each other. So it really depends where you live in terms of whether the peace agreement made your life better or worse. I don't think you can really say, you know, it's better for everyone right now, because it is not.
Yeah. Now, let's move on to this AUC. What kind of numbers are we looking at who sort of demobilized? And I'm thinking of these huge farms. I'm imagining a lot of them are way up in the north because of these just latifundios, these huge, huge haciendas that drug dealers and so on had. But are they still engaged in criminal activities, but up in these areas then?
How can I carefully answer this question? So let's say that they're not openly engaged in criminal activities, but the veiled answers that I got from a lot of the ex-paramilitaries directly and from people kind of around them suggested quite heavily that there is still quite a bit of criminal activity going on. Of course, all the people I interviewed, because one of my questions is, have you ever considered going back to an armed group? And a lot of the people that I interviewed said they had, in fact, considered it, and that they continue to get invitations through their networks to join, you know, various different groups. most of them said that they don't want to be involved in that anymore. They often cite because they have children or other things that they're happy on the farm. I'm not sure that all of them were being 100% transparent. There are a few that I suspect are probably still involved in criminal activity just because of the way they answered certain questions. But they all definitely knew people who were still involved. So, I mean, the overall sense is that, you know, if they wanted to go back to criminal activity, it would be one phone call and they'd be in. It's not like it's particularly difficult. And there's, you know, it's interesting because it's been so long, 10, 15 years for a lot of them. And they still have so much resentment about the whole process. And there were so many of them who said they felt abandoned by the state. They felt like the state didn't fulfill any of the promises. And it was this weird echo of what I had been hearing in the FARC camps about how the agreement had all been lies, how the government didn't fulfill anything. And then here I'm talking to ex-paramilitaries who were kind of echoing the same things, but for them, they've been demobilized for over a decade now. So that was a bit, I guess, disheartening perhaps, although not exactly surprising. What was interesting to me though, because all of these ex-paramilitaries that I interviewed all collectively demobilized. So unlike my FARC interviews where I had a group that had deserted and a group that had stayed, kind of comparing, you know, people who leave and people who don't, with the AUC, almost all of them collectively demobilized. There weren't very many desertions in the paramilitaries in general. And what was interesting to me is that a lot of them that I talked to, because one of my questions was, did you ever think of leaving? And almost all of them said yes. Almost all of them said at some point they wanted to leave, but they didn't because they were too scared of their own group.
I can imagine that. So, I mean, let's say, because I remember, you know, last year and perhaps the year before, many, I don't know if it's the top ranking ones, middle ranking ones or low ranking ones, were actually getting out of jail. Those who admit, had crimes and had faced some sort of justice. And there was the fear that, of course, that they would return to their habitual regions, the regions that they were from and the regions where they had committed such heinous crimes. Did you get to talk to some of these people?
Well, I think most of them now are out of jail because I think the average was about 8 years. Yeah. I'd have to go back and look at my notes, but I think it was 8 years. And there have been a lot of complaints about that because if you look at the FARC, for example, I mean, the whole justice component was one of the big issues in opposing the peace agreement. But most of the members of the Secretariat are not serving jail time. So that is a big resentment factor on the paramilitary side. Well, how come all our commanders went to jail and none of the FARC commanders are going to jail? And it's everyone I talked to, they were always talking about the other group and how they were getting better benefits than we are. And it didn't matter which group I spoke to, it would always be the others that were better off than them. So there's still a lot of this. Even though they're all technically civilians now, there's still a lot of this tension between, well, them and us. I would say it's hard to track numbers of recidivism and know for sure how many people go back to armed activity. But just based on the answers that I got from my interviews, it seems like it's pretty common. And that, I mean, there's a lot of good research on this, especially by Human Rights Watch and a couple other organizations on just the criminal networks that have stayed in place. But I found it really interesting, the ones living on these farms. So one thing that I found really interesting about since we're talking about the kind of justice and the people who went to jail and stuff. So I did talk to a few people who had done jail time and had come out, both on the FARC side and the paramilitary side. But of course, I don't talk to the ones who are out in the mountain still active in armed groups, right? So that's the one section of the population that I can't really talk to. the ones who had spent time in jail all spoke about their time in jail as like a really probably the most difficult time out of all of their experiences before the group, in the group, in jail, after the group. They all kind of spoke about that time in jail as the really the worst part of it. Actually, a lot of them didn't want to talk about their time in jail at all, and it seemed like quite a traumatizing time. So they, most of them just really didn't want to talk about that at all. But what was interesting from kind of the justice and peace perspective was that, sorry, I'm just looking at my notes because there was something that I wanted to say, and then I went on a different track and then I lost it, but it will come back to me. Sorry, but you can edit that part out. I think what was interesting to me with the paramilitaries, especially the second group of paramilitaries I interviewed. So the first group seemed more genuine and more authentic to me, less suspicious. They were all super happy to have me there. We ate with them. I mean, it's weird, right? It's this old drug traffickers hacienda, this big sprawling estate with, like, you know, this four-story mansion and like this old dilapidated out of use pool, and it's all just like fallen into total disarray. Like, you can imagine how it probably used to be this amazing, you know, mansion, and they just, it's just all like dilapidated and falling apart, and the plumbing doesn't work properly, and you just think, wow. No wonder people are going back to armed groups, because this is kind of depressing. Like, if you're used to living in, you know, if you're used to living with tons of money all the time and getting whatever you want all the time, and a lot of them talk about this, you know, they never had problems getting medicine when they were in their armed groups. They never had problems, you know, with food. They were never hungry. And a lot of them talk about how, you know, life after demobilization is worse because it's more stressful, because they're always worried about, you know, if they deserted, they're worried about their armed group tracking them. If they demobilize collectively, they're still worried about different armed groups tracking them down. They talk about the stigma of society. A lot of the paramilitaries talked about how they had a job, but then as soon as the employer found out that they were ex-paramilitary, they lost the job, because there tends to be an even larger stigma against the paramilitary than against the guerrillas, just because their reputation, they were known for being particularly brutal and violent. So for them, the stigma and the ability to hold a job, even now, even, you know, 13, 14 years later, is very high. They all talked about that, about how they kind of try to keep hidden their past, because if people find out, they get very ostracized and can lose jobs and lose friends. And so they were all talking about that. But what I found very interesting in terms of the justice and peace element, so I remembered what I wanted to say, was that when I, in the second group of paramilitaries that I interviewed, the first one was I think more genuine, and I got less of a sense that they were lying to me. But the second set, they were almost all lying to me, which I found very interesting. Because you can tell when people are lying, for one thing. But most of them kept telling me, because one of my first questions is, like, how long were you in the group? Like, how old were you when you enrolled, and how long were you in the group? Just really basic statistical questions, right? And in the second set of paramilitaries, most of them were telling me 12 months, 16 months, 18 months. But then the stories they were telling me did not match someone who had only been in a group for, you know, a year. And what I realized quite quickly was that they, when they demobilized, they would have said at demobilization how long they were in the group. And because it was the middle and high commanders that were culpable and went to jail, if you said that you were only in a group for 16 months, then it was less likely that you were culpable for anything. So then you wouldn't go to jail. So then finally, when I got someone to be honest with me, he at first told me he had been in the group for 18 months. And then he kind of looked at me sideways and he's like, well, do you want the real answer? Well, of course I want the real answer. And then he told me, well, actually, he had been in for 5 years. And he told me that probably no one was telling me the truth, because they have to keep a consistent story. If they told the government 16 months, then they want to tell me 16 months too, because they don't know, you know, because they don't, no one trusts anyone, right? They, no matter, you know, how the confidentiality forms and everything that I show them, they still aren't 100% sure that I'm not going to turn around and give this information to the government. They were really suspicious, actually, because they told me that they had been tricked other times by the government. I mean, who knows how much of this is actually true, but they told me that, you know, the Fiscalía come and with the prosecutor's office had come and had pretended to be someone else and tricked them into signing these papers that they didn't know what they were signing. And so there's a lot of distrust, a lot of skepticism, a lot of suspicion. So it took me a while to kind of, you know, hang out with them and really get them to trust me. One of the strangest experiences I had, which is less research and more just funny, was we were in the house of one of the ex-AUC members who was clearly a former commander, just because of the deference that everyone else gave to him, right? Like, he was the main gatekeeper. He was the first person we had to talk to get permission to go to these farms. And it was very clear that he was a high-ranking person, except then when I actually interviewed him, he said something like 13 months or something, and that he never had any kind of rank, which was clearly not true. But anyway, so we were there, and he, you know, starts passing rum around. So I went from having beer with FARC commanders in the jungle to having rum with a paramilitary commander in his house. And it was as if that wasn't surreal enough. He pulled out this 4-page typed poem and read the entire thing out loud to me. And it was just the strangest moment of my life. And I've had quite a few strange moments, but it was just, okay, so now we're having rum with paramilitaries and he's reading me a poem about the war. And then afterwards, no one really knew what to do. Do we clap? Do we say something? It was very strange, but it was a great example of how we have these stereotypes of who these people are and what these people are. And here, this clearly a former AUC commander, now he writes poetry and makes children's toys.
That is somewhat incongruous. I have a question on the back of that. Was the poetry any good?
I don't know if I'm in position to assess poetry in Spanish. I don't know. I mean, it was interesting because it was all about the war and his perspective on the war. And he actually gave me a copy of it, which was fantastic. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how to assess. I don't know how to assess poetry in another language, but it was interesting.
When you know that they're lying, when you know these people are lying, how are you going to process this information for your academic research?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. So I was talking to my supervisor about this because there were quite a few instances where I knew that they were lying. So either in both sides, like with the FARC in the reintegration camps and in the paramilitaries.
Yes.
So in the FARC, for example, a lot of the women would tell me that they were just cooks or they were just nurses, and then, you know, later when you're just having conversations with people over beer, then it comes up in conversation. Oh, have you talked to so-and-so yet? Did you know that she was in the personal bodyguard of the secretariat? And I'd not say out loud, but I'd be thinking to myself, well, yes, I did talk to her, and that is not what she told me at all. And then in the paramilitaries, you know, lying to me about how long they had been in the group and all that kind of stuff. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a section on misrepresentation and lying, because I think that what people lie about reveals a lot, not the lie itself, but what specifically they're lying about. And the vast majority of people who lied to me that I know of were lying to me about their rank, or were lying to me about how long they had been in the group. And not lying upwards, like saying they were a commander when really they were a foot soldier, lying downwards. So, you know, they probably were a high-ranking person based on how other people treat them and based on the stories that they told. But then they would say that they were just a, you know, they were just a normal foot soldier. So, yeah, in terms of analysis, it's tricky, right? Because you have the spreadsheet of, like, you know, how old they were when they joined and how many years they were in the group. And so, you know, do I put in what they actually told me or do I put in what my guess is? So for those people, I've put in what they actually told me with a little asterisk to note that this is likely untrue. For example, the one man who told me initially 16 months and then asked if I wanted the truth and then told me 5 years, after my interview with him, we got along really great and had a really great chat. He said to me, oh, you know who you should talk to? This other guy, he lives in that house. He's my cousin. He's the one who recruited me. He has loads of experience, way more than I do. But I had already interviewed that guy and he had told me he had been in the group for 16 months.
Well, it's a security blanket, isn't it?
Absolutely.
When you get through, let's say, this barrier, this initial security, as the verbal security, and you get through, like the guy looking sideways at you and saying, "What do you want the truth?" Do they tell you about their time in the group, in the paramilitaries, or perhaps what they were found guilty for? Did you hear some of the terrifying stories?
Yeah, you know, I found the interviews with the paramilitaries emotionally quite difficult, which was interesting to me because I had already been through so many interviews at that point and heard so many horrible stories that I thought, like, I'm prepared for this. I'm relatively immune to this now. I've heard all the stories, so I'm going to be fine. But what shook me in the paramilitary interviews was not the stories of what they did. What shook me was how psychologically disturbed a lot of them still were about the things that they had done. So many of these big, tough paramilitary guys crying in the interviews, saying, you know, they still have nightmares, saying that they had to kill their friends and now they have no friends, saying, I can't even tell you what I did out there because you wouldn't even believe it. And some of them did tell me, even though, you know, part of my protocol in my interviews is that I don't directly ask about illegal activities. And I say that to them, they don't have to disclose anything illegal. But a lot of them do. A lot of them told me all kinds of things that they had done. But a lot of them said they couldn't even talk about the things that they had done because they were still so traumatized by it. And so it wasn't the actual stories that really shook me. It was watching these mostly men, really, because I couldn't interview very many paramilitary women because there just aren't very many of them. But it was the men more than the women who seemed really, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate, but who seemed still quite broken. And that, you know, in the group, they'd be laughing and having beer and it would be all like funny and jokes and you know, we're strong macho men, kind of facade, you know, and then we would go aside and be speaking one-on-one and some of them couldn't even make eye contact with me when they, you know, said certain things. And so many of them would be crying, talking about the things that they had done and talking about how they either tried to leave several times or were caught or they wanted to leave, but they were too scared to leave. So I think that's an important thing to consider is that, you know, in a lot of my proposals and a lot of my work that I've written, I talk about comparing, you know, the defectors and the loyalists or the defectors and the adherents, basically just the people who stayed and the people who left. But I don't think really you can say all the people who stayed are loyal to the cause, because that's not necessarily why people stayed. Some people stayed just because they couldn't leave. And I think that's an important thing to remember is that, you know, some people were tricked into joining and when they realized what it was, then they couldn't leave. And so it's not like, I don't know. It's just so easy to say, oh, the paramilitaries, those, they were really bad dudes. And yes, a lot of them were, definitely, and still are. But a lot of them were just poor farmers who had no work and were offered a job, and they didn't really understand what the job was. And then once they realized what they were in, they couldn't get out.
We talked about this at length in the last one, in 251, was the lack of psychosocial help that these former guerrillas, paramilitaries have received. And of course, we repeated that it's really limited as well for the FARC. I mean, I just sort of see this, you know, them talking to you is almost cathartic, of course. They may not feel good about it, but there's something there. Is there an issue of substance abuse or anything like that in these camps, but people trying to just forget what's gone on in the past, what they've been involved in?
Well, of course, they all speak staunchly against the drug trade, which is ironic and a bit funny. But I mean, I don't know in terms of drug abuse. There's definitely a lot of alcohol consumption. A lot. I don't remember if when I was there, I showed you the picture that I had taken of all the empty beer bottles in the FARC camp. But I know there, I can email it to you. There's this entire wall of crates of empty beer bottles in two of the three camps that we went to. And kind of, you know, same thing at the, in the paramilitary farms, but less. Because in those farms, I mean, they're all working. They have been like, they're civilians now, right? I mean, some of them might still be involved in crime, but I think most of the people on these farms genuinely just, you know, have their families and are trying to make ends meet. So there's less idleness, I guess I would say, in that, you know, when I went there, a lot of the interviews happened in the evening because during the day, most of them were working. Whereas in the FARC camps, there was a lot of idleness. There was a lot of people just sitting around doing nothing. And then, you know, a lot of young people, you know, mostly men sitting around doing nothing and, you know, not wanting to stereotype, but just by extension of just the idleness and the kind of frustration at not having work, there was a lot of alcohol consumption. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting because there was one guy in the paramilitaries, actually two guys that I interviewed in the paramilitaries, who credited the AUC for getting them off drugs.
Wow.
That they had been addicts before, but then the AUC was hiring and they wanted a job, and the AUC refused to hire them because they were addicts. So they got clean, like while in the group, or so that they could, you know, be in the group, which is just wildly ironic when you think about it. You know, these groups that are basically their main source of income is the drug trade, but at the same time, they're, you know, doing social cleansing of drug addicts and insisting that everyone in their ranks is not using drugs. Anyway, I find it all quite fascinating.
That's quite fascinating. And if I could turn this, in this final couple of minutes that we've got, turn this around to you. Have you needed any sort of psychological treatment, or would you look for that after these, you know, harrowing interviews?
Right. It's a great question. And don't let me forget, there's one thing I want to say about a language as well, because we did talk about that last week, and there's an addition to that with the paramilitaries. I mean, I really think, and I've talked to other researchers about this, particularly PhD candidates, that our universities don't properly prepare us for this kind of work, and nor do we get any kind of debrief or anything when we get back. It's really just up to us to figure that out, which is probably not the best. But thankfully, I mean, I have a lot of my own life experience with trauma, so I'm pretty good at knowing, you know, when I need to see someone. I do a lot of yoga and meditation, and that really helps. And, you know, we got a puppy, so I'm calling her my therapist puppy. And, you know, and she helps too, because I, you know, can't be so serious all the time when there's a puppy that needs to be played with. But really, she's actually really helped. At the end of my trip, I really felt quite just completely depleted just from absorbing all of these horrible stories and, you know, people using me as a therapist, basically. I mean, not everyone, but a lot of people, you know, kind of using the opportunity to vent their frustrations and to talk about their horrors. And thankfully, I do have training for that. I think it would have been a lot more difficult if I were a PhD candidate going into this, having no experience with this kind of interviews and having no experience working with people with trauma. But thankfully, I do have that experience. So I think that that served me well. But it still affected me in a huge way and continues to as I continue to listen to all these interviews all over again, because there are some stories that I forgot about. And now I'm back home. I mean, because over 100 interviews, right? I don't remember every single one. But now that I'm home and I'm listening to them, it's like hearing all this trauma all over again. So it's just, you know, it's kind of this repeated, you have to learn how to protect yourself a bit and not absorb it all into your own body, if that makes sense.
No, I believe this very profoundly. It affects your very being.
Yeah, it definitely does. And especially because it's one thing, like I said earlier, it's one thing to speak of the group, you know, oh, the paramilitaries or the paramilitary death squads or the FARC guerrillas, whatever. But it's a very different thing to meet these people individually and to see how their membership in these groups came to be, like the reasons that they enrolled in the first place and how the activities in those groups affected them in terms of their mental health, in terms of their family. I mean, that's another thing, right? So many broken families. All of these ex-combatants have multiple children, often in several different parts of the country. And just the displacement. And yeah, I mean, sometimes I just have to focus on the data and the analysis and not think about it like a human being. But other times you have to think about it like a human being, and it can be a bit overwhelming. And that's when the puppy comes in handy.
I'm glad for the visual there. And listen, when your book comes out, Rachel, will you come back on the show and tell us about it and the experience and the reception?
Oh, yes. And I'm hoping to come back to Colombia soon as well. So we'll see. Can I tell you one thing about language? Because we talked about it last week, or not last week, last time.
last time.
It feels like a week ago. So when I was speaking with the FARC, you remember how they were very, the ones in the camps, the collectively demobilized combatants, were very firm on that they were not desmobilizados, right? Yeah. They were reincorporados. And they were very firm about that, whereas the deserters didn't really care what you called them, whatever, it didn't matter, except that they, aside from the fact that they didn't like the word desertor, like they didn't like the word deserter, but you could call them demobilized or ex-combatant or whatever, and they didn't care. So then I went to my first AUC interview, and I told him how I was kind of comparing desmobilizados with reincorporados. And he was so excited that I was doing this, but because he identified as a desmobilizado. And so then I was really confused. So then he told me that the collectively demobilized AUC consider themselves to be desmobilizados, demobilized. The deserters who left the paramilitaries, they call them reintertados. So it was yet another term. So for the paramilitaries, they had different language that they wanted to be called by. The guerrillas had other language they wanted to be called by. And the words that you used and the words that I used in the interviews were so important depending on the group. I had to be really careful the kind of language that I was using. And once I got a hold of that language, once I started using their language, then there was this assumption that, okay, you understand us, you're on our side. So then they would kind of give me all this information as though I was on their side. When, of course, I was always very careful to be clear that I was on no one's side. But it seemed like as soon as you start using their language, there's this level of, the second level of trust of like, oh, okay, she gets how we see this. She gets how we want to be called. And then that would kind of open up the the interview a bit. But yeah, the first initial interviews when I didn't quite have the paramilitary language yet, I learned you have to learn super quickly what words are taboo and what words are okay, because they take that very seriously.
I love this study of language and how delicate it has to be. I find this issue of a deserter from the AUC is known as a reinsertado. And when you think of what a reinsertado really possibly means for a FARC guerrilla, the difference is just immense.
Right? I know. I was so fascinated. I might have a whole chapter just on language and the words. I don't know. I'm not sure how I'm going to incorporate that, but I found that really fascinating.
Well, Rachel, unfortunately, we just don't have enough time to go through all of this.
We really don't.
But let me just say thank you so much for being back on the show. I know this is going to, this is another incredibly popular episode. And I hope that maybe a bit of the winter lifts there in Ottawa and you know, you're able to sift through all of these 100 plus interviews with success. And I wish you all the success with this thesis.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this is really the hard part now, is just wading through, sitting at my kitchen counter and wading through all the data.
So, well, thank you again. I've been Richard McCall for the Columbia Calling podcast, talking to Rachel Schmidt in Ottawa, Canada. This has been episode 264. We're signing off now. Thank you for all the feedback in recent weeks. We're still, you know, polishing things up and letting things settle as well. We'll be back next week with further interviews of interesting people doing something to do with Colombia. Thank you for listening, and bye-bye.